Please get yourself a copy of the Constitution.
It's just a
This was published by a constitutional center and has the Declaration of Independence in it. The Constitution intentionally is not long. It's a framework, and I have to read it over and over and over because questions come up to me in my mind, and I'm thinking, well, what? Let me go back and see what the Constitution said about that. So get yourself, you can buy these in bulk. Any bookstore would have them. This is the Meacham book that I've talked about. And again, it's John Meacham's latest, and it's an anthology. It's sort of like In Our Own Words across our history time. So it's very worth having on your shelf. Some of you ask about Frederick Douglass and a good book on him. Frederick Douglass was always important in our history. He's becoming more so, and even Rochester is awakening to how they need to honor him big time. And Rita and I have been to his grave, by the way, and to that cemetery. But
Is it in New York?
it's in Rochester, New York, which he fled to get away from being recaptured as a slave. This is the best book. I asked some colleagues, scholars, David Blight, Frederick Douglass. I just got it. For someone to have experienced the worst of America, to become still a champion of America, speaks to the strength of what we're studying, Declaration of Independence, and the strength of the continuity of that value through hard times, if it's going to continue as a value. We started July 4, 1776, and the context, which was sort of a life and death context. Because the British, 30 to 40,000 British soldiers were on their way about to land at Long Island to invade and to put down this rebellion. And out of that emerged the Declaration. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men, and they would say today, we have to say today, all women, men, boys, and girls, red, black, brown, are equal. And that, to me, was the culmination of the Enlightenment, humanism rising, rationalism, using the power of the human mind, not be bound totally by tradition, either scientific tradition or religious tradition, whatever. And emerging in more democratization of government, Great Britain was already an example of more democratization, still a very strong and stubborn monarchy, but Parliament certainly existed. And the whole world at that time looked at the British Empire as the most advanced in terms of justice and rights and those kinds of things. And that greatly influenced, of course, the British citizens on this continent. But out of that arose the Declaration. So at the same time, there were those who signed on to the Declaration because it was very aspirational, but didn't agree with the statement of equality. And that was in the beginning. We had controversy over this, and we followed some of that through. We advance 11 years, and we come to the Constitution formation, and the preamble of that it's almost scripture. I think Pauline Meyer would say it's included in the canon of American scripture, political scripture. We, the people of the United States, in order to create a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution of the United States of America. So these are our words that the people voted on and the people adopted and ordained. It went through a vast democratic process of ratification. So bear that all in mind. When George Washington realized the Revolutionary War was over and had been won, he issued a circular letter to the states that's worth reading, always worth reading. His farewell letter at his presidency is a document that ought to be embedded in American mind. But he said this, at this auspicious point, 1783, the United States came into existence as a nation. And if their citizens should not be completely free and happy, the fault will be entirely their own. And I've wondered for years, can Americans ever be happy? We're the freest and most active and most powerful civilization ever. But it seems we have a hard time, really hard time, being happy. Now, maybe it's just a part of our nature as free people to grumble about almost everything. I don't know, but it's worth pondering. What would it take to make us happy? The greatest sin we Americans ever created was chattel slavery, and it is the diametric opposite of the Declaration of Independence. And they all knew it. But it would either work out in time or slavery would go out of existence, or you know, whatever. They couldn't fix it at the time. We're not debating that. But Frederick Douglass was always the one so blunt, outspoken about slavery. And he was invited to speak to a large audience in Rochester, probably mostly women in the audience, and it was on the 4th of July he was asked to talk about the Declaration of Independence. And the early part of his speech, he didn't hold back any punches. The existence of slavery in this country brands your republicanism, small r, brands your republicanism as a sham, your humanity as a base pretense, and your Christianity is a lie. Slavery destroys your moral power. Absolutely. It fetters your progress. It is the enemy of improvement, the deadly foe of education. It promotes vice. It shelters crime. Woo! Now, thank God we don't have chattel slavery anymore. We still have subordination, victimization, domination, etc., which is a variation of slavery. So we go on to the Civil War coming and secession and the forming of the Confederacy, and the vice president of the Confederacy under Jefferson Davis was Alexander Stephens, and he wrote a manifesto about the Confederacy that in the first paragraph vehemently disagreed with Jefferson and the Committee of Five and the Constitutional Continental Congress in issuing the Declaration, and he says they were wrong. He says, our new government, meaning the Confederacy, is founded upon the opposite idea. The great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery subordination to the superior race is his natural condition. the founders, the framers of the Declaration, they were attempting to make things equal, which the Creator had made unequal. This is the Confederate States of the United of the of America. Okay, Declaration Manifesto. Talking about equality, not so with the Negro. Subordination is his place. He by nature is fitted for that condition. You can't state it any more bluntly than that. That is the white supremacist ideology. It's always here. Americans did not create it. It came from Europe, white supremacy. So this just puts it right out there in our own words. The other side of America, as we've tried to say, was based on equality of being, we come into the world as God's creatures with an equality. There, so this statement that Stevens just made, ordained by God, white supremacy. And it's embedded underneath somewhere or on top of all of the Christian nationalism that we're experiencing. Christian nationalism is a threat to America in a great variety of ways. Sometime we could talk more about that. Civil War comes. We talked last week about the Emancipation Proclamation, and the Confederacy was in a sense stopped at Gettysburg, July 1, 2, 3 of 1863. The next day, Vicksburg fell, and the Confederacy was over. It was a cleanup operation after that. That said, Lincoln's assassinated April of 65 after his re-election, and who becomes president? Andrew Johnson. And I'm not sure Tennesseans come out too well in one week. Andrew Johnson and James K. Polk. Anyway, here is President Andrew Johnson. In our own words, his title of this manifesto was "To Relapse into Barbarism." Negroes have shown less capacity for government than any other race of people. No independent government of any form has ever been successful in the hands of these so utterly ignorant of public affairs. I ought therefore to be reposed, that is, comforted, in none except those who are fitted morally and mentally to administer it well, that is, administer government well.
And that's Andrew Johnson.
That's Andrew Johnson. So that was another manifesto to the South. Racial domination is well and in place, and you can continue to enforce it. What else would they mean? What else would they interpret? So here again, the seeds are planted for the fear of Black people being equal, for Black people to participate in the government, Black people to vote, hold office, all those kinds of things. So we get 100 years of Southern apartheid. And instead of the South choosing something in the context of Reconstruction that could have been positive, that could have moved toward coexistence, they chose violence, terrorism, and poverty. And the South stayed in poverty. That's a big generalization, but stayed in poverty for another 100 years. Ironically, the president that I believe helped save the South from itself was FDR. It was Roosevelt that created and pushed Tennessee Valley Authority, TVA, hydroelectric dams to save the soil, number one, to save towns from being washed away in floods, generate electricity, provide rural electrification that helped pull the South out of poverty. Now, so we get past the Civil War and even Reconstruction. Reconstruction, by the way, was more positive than you give it credit for. Eric Foner is the historian you need to read on the Reconstruction. But by the late 1800s, we're starting to see fissures in the American experience with where agricultural folks are beginning to resent the industrial folk. Farm against city, rural against city. You had the populist movements in the 1890s around William Cullen Bryan, ran for president about three times. But this was kind of an agrarian America pushing back against cities and industrial tycoons and so forth. So we get rural poverty and urban ghettos during this period of time. This is the context in which Teddy Roosevelt became president on the death of Warren G. Harding. So William McKinley. Harding did die too in office, but the assassination of William McKinley. And Teddy Roosevelt becomes this amazing accidental president, you know, who set a new standard, tried to address some injustices, tried to address unfairness with between management and labor. Let's fast forward on into the 1920s, which was a period of just wealth and technology. That was unprecedented. It's post World War I. A lot of wealth flowed to America. Farm equipment was booming, which meant you could produce more, but folks couldn't buy more. We get a bubble. We get one of the biggest bubbles ever in our history financially. Wall Street was literally crazy because the thinking at that time was, your investment cannot fail. And you will make money, big money, on anything you invest in. Well, that bubble just kept growing and burst in October 1929. And a lot of scholars have asked the question, how did the American people, the ones who were suffering the most during the Great Depression, how did they stay patriotic when everything was against them and the system had failed? And the general line of thought is that there was something they believed in deeper. And I think it's this notion of equality. I matter. I belong. I'm here. This is my country, too. Then we get then into the rise of totalitarianism in Japan and in Germany in the 30s and into the 40s. And at the heart of Hitler's project was the purity of the Aryan race, as you know. And there are a lot of people today still admire that project. Is frightening. The New Deal, a woman you need to know and study if you haven't is Frances Perkins. FDR brought her in as Secretary of Labor. She helped create Social Security, unemployment insurance, worker safety, and it was that administration, as far as I know, maybe TR raised it, is national health care, some kind of national health care safety net. And FDR promoted it. FDR issued in those very dark days of totalitarianism the four freedoms, and you need to review those: freedom of speech and expression, the freedom of worship, the freedom from want, and the freedom from fear. And those were very targeted expressions that had to do with the existential quality of living for all human beings around the world. Now, move into the Eisenhower presidency. He, of course, was the helped engineer the victory in Europe, D-Day, and so forth. It was when he retired out of the military, he was recruited by both Democrats and Republicans to run for president. And Eisenhower governed as a New Deal president, and everybody did. Bill Reagan functioned out of the New Deal model, which was that government can do good for the people, as opposed to government is the enemy. Eisenhower turns out to be a civil rights president, and he was the one who defended the Supreme Court decision in 1954. He was the one who backed down Governor Faubus in Arkansas and Little Rock. Gross racism and brutality on television. It was Eisenhower that backed them down. Let's see. So that's it. That was a big stage setting. But there was something that emerged in the Eisenhower years, two things actually, that are continuing to be an issue for us. One was Vietnam. Eisenhower was the first to send military advisors to Vietnam in 1954. I believe it was 54. And we stayed 20 minutes. And it was goes down as a mistake that still haunts, killed 58,000 Americans. Oh, man. So that was a set of decisions that still overshadow us. Cuba. America had decided to support Castro in his movement to overthrow the mafia in Cuba. And it was only when Castro then won the revolution and declared that it would be a communist state that then the Eisenhower administration, said, well, now we can't support him at all. And there was a CIA operation being planned to try to overthrow Castro in 58 and 59. And that operation was still alive when John F. Kennedy became president and Bobby Kennedy became Attorney General. And Bobby Kennedy inherited the CIA plan. And the more he and the Kennedys hated Castro. So there's no love lost there. It was a matter of, is this the right thing to do? Is this, could this be successful? Will it cause more harm than good and so forth? So the Kennedys began to sour on the CIA operation. Bay of Pigs, all those things. We still live with all of that.
If Castro had been a better second baseman, none of this would have happened because he was in the minor league system of the Washington Senators and got cut and went home
I didn't know that.
and was so popular after the revolution, he appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show to great standing ovation. But then we soured on
It
it.
reminds me of another little piece of history. Ho Chi Minh, after World War II, went to the superpowers, the Allied powers, and begged them not to let France recolonize Vietnam. And the Allies, which included Eisenhower, did not listen. And he said, okay, if you're going to, and France did recolonize, and Ho Chi Minh went back and said, okay, I'm going to form guerrilla warfare. You see the mistakes and the opportunities that were there, just bad choices at certain times. Let's see, let's fast forward into Kennedy's assassination, and Johnson becomes president, and here again is an accidental president who turns out to do a lot of good things. And I know what how controversial Johnson is. He knew how to gain power, and he was ruthless in using power, but it was generally legislative power. So when he wanted to win over the Kennedy faction, and he was going to do his best to fulfill some of the Kennedy agenda. The civil rights legislation that did get passed in 64, 65, Johnson himself said to his colleagues, now we have forfeited the South to the Republicans for 100 years. And how true, how pathetic that was. Who picked up on that? Nixon. And Nixon developed what he called the Southern Strategy. And that's where you have racist codes, you know, the code language that's sent. Now, I want to, turning points in political philosophy and so forth. 1964 was a good one. Kennedy had been assassinated. Johnson's president. Johnson's going to run for a second term and had not yet gotten his legislative package approved in Congress. And so Republicans, Democrats, well, Democrats were going to nominate him. Republicans were at a fork in the road. And the reason I brought this book, Jacob Javits. Who remembers Jacob Javits? Jacob Javits, Jewish, decided to run for Congress, House of Representatives, in a strong Democratic district. And he just worked his tail off, and he won. So he's a congressman, later becomes a senator. But probably the most progressive Republican, save Lincoln, ever. And I happened to get this book and read it. And this is a program for good government, right kind of government, in my opinion, my view. It parallels Henry Clay. And Henry Clay and the Whig Party and what they call the American system, a lot of parallel here. He wrote this book to run for president. And a guy by the name of Barry Goldwater wrote another book to run for president. And the Republicans had to cheat. Out of all of that, just, you know, I tell my kids, look, I grew up in the 60s, well, in the desegregation era, and then the 60s, where we had three assassinations, cities burning, we had Vietnam, and then we had Watergate. Then out of that, we get Nixon. Nixon was a scoundrel all the way through his career. Couldn't tell the truth. Paranoia. Was his theme. Could have been one of our greatest presidents. He was very smart. He had a global vision. He opened the relations with China. He created the Environmental Protection Agency. He had a lot of progressive ideas, but his demons did him in. So, you know, these are just very hard times. We get then the context for Reagan. Now, isn't it interesting that presidential interests moved west in Goldwater, Nixon, and Reagan, which was partly the country was saying, we're tired of Eastern establishment. That's why Andrew Jackson got elected president, by the way. They're tired of the Eastern establishment. Aristocrats and well-to-do and elites and the wealth. So this mindset, you know, keeps going west. We get more Vietnam, we get Watergate and a resignation. And we get, of course, George H.W. Bush. Well, we get the Reagan time, and we need to study that, because I know Reagan was a very likable person, and I think in his heart was a good person. Governor, successful governor of California twice. Good morning in America, shining city on a hill. He knew how to craft a positive message that also was caught by the underbelly. Never forget where Reagan launched his campaign. Mississippi. Philadelphia, Mississippi. But he was trying to signal two opposite things. Now, where America's wealth started being sucked to the top was in the Reagan era.
Trickle down.
It's a trickle down philosophy, supply side economics, which has never worked, but it was popular. It sounded good. Let's try to bring this part to conclusion, in that we, in the mid-90s, when we had the Clinton administration, Newt Gingrich came to power. And I contend that Newt Gingrich poisoned the American political environment more than anybody. He was a sinister, he is a sinister person. And I would say, if I had to have a benchmark of when the Republican Party started into what it is today, was at Gingrich, at the Gingrich time. He wanted government shutdowns, all that kind of stuff. He and Clinton, you know, Clinton figured him out enough to get through that. Now, so we get George H.W. presidency after Reagan. He was probably as well prepared as any person we have elected as president. And he started very quickly to try to clean up some of the Reagan mess, which was financial. Because Reagan, see, a conservative, you may agree that he disagreed, that he marketed himself as a conservative and immediately started spending. Deficit spending, national debt rising, at the same time cutting taxes, massive tax cuts for the wealthy. That's where the shift started. He spent money on military buildup. And we can argue policy, you know, we can argue policy, but
since then, the deficit has gone down under Democrats and up under Republicans.
Exactly. And that's one of the lies that we choose to live with, is that Republicans are fiscal conservatives, Democrats are expenders. It's not true. And Clinton was the only one that got a balanced budget agreement. Remember?
Yes.
94, I believe. How many Republicans voted for that package? None.
Mm-hmm.
Not a single Republican voted. Well, that bill, that was a pathway to a balanced budget, but nobody remembers that. And so, and Republicans, more than anybody, have given up on the national debt. In other words, they don't even talk about it anymore, because they're the ones that have skyrocketed. Heard just the other day that Trump's 6 years in office, he's responsible for 28% of the current national debt. Staggering. And these represent how we get bamboozled into mythologies that are lies that we adopt as truth. You know, I had a dear friend who was in financial industries, tell me once, he said, you know, John, during the Republican presidency, the stock market goes up and the Democrat presidency goes down. Well, I don't know what history he was reading. It's not true. Not true. Now, so we get a lot of backlash stuff. We get George W. and 9/11, which was horrible and awful. And it changed America more than we're still willing to admit. And we began to turn inward. If you study the rise and fall of empires, it's when they get scared and turn inward to protect themselves that they start the decline. And for Spain, which was one of the great worldwide empires for so long, you can mark a very special day, 1492. We remember for Columbus. It was the same year that Spain began to evict, deport, crack down on what they thought were the enemies of the state. So you can just, some of these patterns are amazing. So we get to the Trump mega era. Lincoln warned us long before he was ever a candidate for president about demagogues. And it was in his famous 1838 speech before the Springfield Lyceum. By this time, he's an established lawyer in Springfield. And he talks about how this nation has become so good and so great, and we have deep rights and laws. And so he's trying to address the question, how do we keep it? Because the founding generation, the revolutionary generation, the constitutional generation, are now they've died on goblins wherever they go. And so the country's starting to think about, what do we keep going? How do we keep it going? And America's growing so fast, and population's doubling every 10 years. And the economy's booming, and westward movement is booming. And he was asked to address this question before the Lyceum, so you can read that speech. But he says, in the midst of all of this happiness and prosperity, there will be other reapers who want a piece of the action. And men of ambition and will spring up among us, he says. Ambition, and we'll push that ambition to the utmost stretch. We'll at some time spring up among us, and they will seek distinction, whether it be for good or for ill. They could have been building up, but he, this figure, this will set boldly to the task of pulling it down. And you don't have to be a prophet to know in human existence these things happen. Their abuse of power has been with us from the Garden of Eden. Our earliest ancestors, suspicion of government, all through our history. And you know, as a member, as a dynamic of conservative and liberal, it's okay, you know, as long as we understand what part of government do you not like. You don't like national defense, you don't like roads and bridges, you don't like the postal service. Okay, I want to finish with back to Frederick Douglass in this same speech where he castigated chattel slavery. He ended by saying, therefore, I therefore leave off where I started with hope. While drawing encouragement from the Declaration of Independence, the great principles it contains, and the genius of American institutions, my spirit is also cheered by the obvious tendencies of the age. This is 1852. And what he was observing, I think, tendencies of the age, was the abolitionist movement was gaining ground. The Republican Party was about to be launched. There were things he could see that gave him some encouragement. My spirit is cheer, he said, and goes on that far off and almost fabulous Pacific rolls in grandeur at our feet. And then he has this phrase, the celestial empire. Celestial empire. We would say that's the kingdom of God. Augustine would say that's the city of God. The celestial empire that awaits us, but it's also active here now. The mystery of the ages is being solved. The fiat of the Almighty, that is the order of the Almighty, the will of the Almighty, has not yet spent its force. Martin Luther King later would say, the moral arc of the universe. Now, so I want to finish with what was said just 2 weeks ago. Well, it's on the wall of the obelisk in South Chicago. You are America, unconstrained by habit and convention, unencumbered by what is, ready to seize what ought to be. For everywhere in this country, there are first steps to be taken. There is a new ground to cover. There are more bridges to cross. America is not the project of any one person. The single most powerful word in our democracy is we. We the people. We shall overcome. Yes, we can. That word is owned by no one. It belongs to everyone. Oh, what a glorious task we are given to continually try to improve this great nation of ours.
This is that.
That was Barack Obama.